move, going deep, speed race. He's got Hill! He's got Hill!
From the Baptist Health Studios, inside the Baptist Health Training Complex, this is Drive Time with Travis Wingfield.
He's got it! Miami is in the playoffs!
What is up, Dolphins, and welcome to the Drive Time Podcast. I am your host, Travis Wingfield, and on today's show, we have another combine recap of sorts for you guys on the episode. We'll talk about the workouts that happened on the field, plus some jibber-jabber from around the NFL media landscape and a heck of a lot more from the Baptist Health Studios. We're back home inside the Baptist Health Training Complex. This is the Drive Time Podcast. So we're back home from Indianapolis, and first off, it was great. It always is. I just think the connectedness, if that's a word, of the downtown area in Indy is what a city is supposed to be, almost like European in its style, because in America and South Florida especially, everything is like a half-hour drive, right? If you venture into Miami itself, and you're not a Broward boy like I am, and you go into that traffic, it's at least an hour-long commute, no matter where you go. But everything in Indy is close. And there are sky bridges and indoor walkways that prevent you from having to bear the cold weather too much. Now, that wouldn't have mattered one iota on Tuesday when it was a record high 65 degrees on a February 28th, I believe was that day, in Indianapolis. Then an overnight massive windstorm pushes in 30-degree temperatures with a consistent 15-mile-per-hour wind and gusts up to 30 miles per hour. And the only part that required outside for me and JT, our great videographer here, was our walk from our hotel to the convention center, and it was literally a quarter mile. But lugging some gear in those temperatures and those winds, whoo, buddy, the humidity down here is so many things, right? And we think often negatively about that. But I'll tell you this, if you haven't left South Florida in some time and gone to a cold weather environment, the way your skin dries out, my goodness, my knuckles were like getting cracked by the end of it. Is that why South Florida is home to so many beautiful folks? I tend to think it is. That the sunshine tends to invite, you know, different type of clothing that requires different type of bodies, right? But I digress from all that. Speaking of bodies and how they look, let's talk about the combine. But still, I want to get more on this Indianapolis life because I also had the best burger of my entire life when I was there and by total accident. So JT, once again, and I went to the Pacers and Pelicans game on Wednesday, which awesome, awesome arena right in the heart of downtown Indianapolis. And after that, we tried to go to this brewery that was right next door because cold weather, didn't want to walk too far, but their kitchen closed at 9, and we got there at 8:45, and I refused to be that guy. JT is what we refused to be those guys. Like, fire up your kitchen. Go ahead and make us some steaks 20 minutes past closing time. It was just burgers, but I wasn't going to do it, right? So the trip was great. Had a great time. Got a chance to talk to some prospects and some media folks and watch the workouts all weekend long, and just really had a great time. So I want to go ahead now, though, and pivot and talk about the actual combine and the on-field workouts, because I know you guys, that's what you come here for, right? You don't care about the great good egg burger I had at the District Tap in downtown Indianapolis. So I want to talk about just a handful of these guys and position groups and what we learned from this year's scouting combine. And it started off, I'm going kind of in order here, with who worked out in order, and it kicked off with the linebackers and defensive line, right? And I took a look at that class, and man, the way Chop Robinson runs, the way Darius Robinson measured in multiple categories, the way Laiatu Latu's film and workout all goes together, I think you look at those three edge players, and I haven't gotten deep enough into it yet to give you real insight perspective on the fifth and sixth round draft picks that you could potentially be looking at in that spot, or even the guys in the third and fourth round, if Miami are to trade back and get themselves back into the middle of this year's draft class, which I hope that's what happens because I think we need more picks in that range to hit and be guys that can be contributors on those cheap rookie contracts. But for the edge group, those three guys, I think, really kind of pinged my interest in terms of guys that could potentially be there. I think Chop ran himself right into the top 20. He's the Penn State guy. I never thought Latu would make it because he's just so damn good, even if the medical isn't where you want it to be. I mean, that's kind of what happened to Jalen Phillips, and he went 18th overall because the measurables and the just – pure production of his playing time and what the tape showed you, it was inarguable, right? It was so good. And I think that's where Latu falls. Whereas Darius Robinson from Missouri, gosh, he has that similar, you know, kind of like Christian Wilkins, inside-outside pivot ability, 293 pounds, really good bend around the edge. And he showed you that with the way he ran the shuttle and the three cone and the 40-yard dash and all the stuff that really measures your movement skills and your explosiveness. So watching those guys get after on that first day makes me think those are some options there at that position. And we're going to talk on Wednesday's podcast about this. I've kind of pivoted out of what I've been telling you guys for a long time here on the podcast. And I've been talking about the interior offensive line, because if you go back over Chris Greer's draft history, the Dolphins draft history since his, you know, appointment in 2016, but really in recent years as well, they haven't gone outside of the premium spots in those draft classes. The one exception to that was Minkah Fitzpatrick. And Minkah Fitzpatrick wasn't really, I mean, he played more cornerback in Miami than he did safety. And when you consider him a safety at Alabama, you knew it was this idea of slot safety mix, you know, rush the quarterback, fit the run, play some perimeter cornerback. Like, you knew it was coming with the caveat that this guy's not just a safety. He can play multiple spots in your secondary and never leave the field. And those guys that do that, like we saw with Derwin James get his big contract, or Minkah himself get those big contracts, you see the value that league places on guys by how they get paid when it comes up to contract time. And so Minkah Fitzpatrick's second contract would tell you that he wasn't in a non-premium position, whether it was with Miami or the Pittsburgh Steelers or Alabama, because he got paid commensurate with guys that have a bigger impact than what your traditional safety will garner, right? And Javon Holland probably falls into a category more along that line than he does, you know, Deshaun Elliott, for instance, who got, you know, played really well last year, but you can see where the safety market kind of comes up short by the compensation there. Or Kyle Hamilton for the Baltimore Ravens, who was the best player in that draft a couple years ago, right? Like, it was clear he was the best player in the damn class. And he goes 14th because he plays a position that doesn't have that value perceived to the other groups. Because if you go back to 2016, first round, Laremy Tunsil. I'm doing my Wednesday podcast bit already. I'm kind of regretting this. 2017, Charles Harris was an edge. 2018, Minkah. 2019, Christian Wilkins, a defensive tackle that has become, again, 85% snap taker, inside-outside versatility. Like, he's going to get paid at a level that shows you that's kind of a premium spot at this stage, or at least on the periphery of premium positional value, right? Like, linebackers don't make that much. Running backs don't make that much. Tight ends don't make that much. Safeties don't make that much. Guards don't make that much. 2020, first round quarterback, offensive tackle, cornerback, like three of the premier positions. 2021, the ones we didn't check off in 2020, receiver and edge. Those are the five premier positions, right? With Waddle and Phillips, those were your picks then. Then 2022, no draft pick, no draft pick in 2023. So was it seven of those nine picks were premium spots? And the two guys that were not premium spots have kind of become premium players from their production and just kind of their usage in general. So I'm kind of pivoting off that thought into, I think the first round probably belongs to a premium position, because what better way to maximize your resources you have and the value of that pick than to make it a player you have for 4 years under cost control rookie contract at a position where when that player hits, like you hope they do by year two, three, or four, and becomes a premier player, you're now getting premier production for a fraction of the cost of what that would cost for an extension, or even more beyond that, the top of the market free agency, right? Because we know that when guys re-sign to their own clubs, and we just saw today, Mike Evans got a new contract from the Buccaneers, which, by the way, how cool is it to watch Jets Twitter meltdown? That was like their top target the entire year. That was kind of how they got themselves through this season, and already before free agency gets here, he's already off the board. I just hate that team so much. But you saw him get paid by the Bucks and take a little bit of a haircut, not much, but he probably could have got more on the open market, because when you get to the open market, it becomes a feeding frenzy, a bidding war, an opportunity for teams to say, well, they offered you this, you know, top of the market. We can go a little bit beyond that and stretch because we have all this cap space, because, by the way, when you have cap space, it means you probably sucked the year before. We have that, so we can afford to pay it to you, and that's what teams tend to do, and that's how you get yourself into cap hell. That's how this team was ran under Mike Tannenbaum for a long time, where they would milk these, you know, aging players who are beyond their prime years of their career and give them money into the back end of their contract with these restructures in order to open up money right now for that one splash signing. And then we drop in Dominican Sue in and have no offensive line, have no running game, have, you know, as you guys would say, the kids out there, mid receivers that has questionable defensive backfield. But we got Dominican Sue, damn it. We won March again. Like, that's how bad teams are ran. And when you can offset those ideas with production at the rookie level, that's where you get your big wins. So I think that the idea for the Dolphins and a lot of teams across the league drafting those premium positions tends to be the smarter play. And when you hit on them, gosh, it works out, because we're going to have like Phillips and Waddle next year, assuming they don't get extended, which maybe they do. But if you have them in the, what would it be, one, two, three, the fourth year of their career, like, they're going to be playing like top 10 receivers and edge rushers, but being paid like, you know, 35th among their position group. That's where you really get the maximum value from those spots. So that's why I include Chop Robinson and Darius Robinson and Leiatu Latu, because I think that position is well within play right there, and it makes sense with how this class could stack up. So those guys, to me, kind of won the early portion of the workout. I want to finish up this first segment talking about the player that really jumped off the workouts for me. Actually, there was a couple of them. The Kentucky linebacker was in there as well. He was really athletic and moved around and showed you some of this ability, because to me, we don't talk about linebackers as a premium position, but man, when you go back and look at the final four teams the last couple of years, they tend to have a couple of traffic cops in the middle of the field who can really erase that deep hook zone, right? Where we live. The Dolphins live on those 15, 18-yard rips on time from Tua to Tyreek, from Tua to Waddle, from Tua to Cedric Wilson. Doesn't matter. Tua to anybody. Tua to me. The linebackers that can minimize that and use length and speed to get depth, but also have the recognition and the length and the speed to get downhill and impact the running game, that all marries off of each other, right? And so those types of players, your Fred Warners, gosh, they sure are valuable. So there are exceptions to every position group, and the Kentucky kid can move. But when I go back to that linebacker group, Peyton Wilson from NC State, man, he looks like the next one to me. Because, again, going back over the Final Four, the Chiefs with Willie Gay and Drew Tranquil and Nick Bolton, or the Niners with Fred Warner and Dre Greenlaw, or the Ravens with Roquan Smith and Patrick Queen, all these teams, the Lions, Alex Anzalone and Jack Campbell both had great years this year as a rookie and a free agent that was kind of cast off from a previous regime, right? All these teams have these guys that can impact the game that way. And the nice part about it is I don't think you have to spend high draft capital to get those types of players. Fred Warner was a second-round draft pick. Roquan Smith went very, very high, but he was like a unicorn in that sense. Patrick Queen was a late first-round draft pick. Dre Greenlaw was drafted way down the board, right? Alex Anzalone was like a fifth-round draft pick. Jack Campbell wasn't the first round, but you can kind of see there's this blend of size, speed, combination, and ability to impact the hook zone. I think that Peyton Wilson might be that guy, and it might not cost you a premium pick to do it. One, because of the positional value and what you're hoping he becomes, which he's not yet, and two, he has the medical history. But this guy can run, man, and he's got the length. It's like almost, it's almost Brian Urlacher-esque, because did you guys ever play Madden back in the day when Brian Urlacher in the rushing attack game just was like bigger than everybody else and faster than everybody else and just ruined it if you were trying to play against that defense? It kind of reminds me of that at his best. So I thought he really won the day on Friday, along with those edge players I talked about. And there's going to be tons of guys we don't cover here on one edition of the podcast, but very interesting crop there. I want to go ahead and take our first break right here and come back and talk about the DBs that ran well and what that group could look like, and also come back and talk about the offense. Plenty more to come your way here on this Monday Combine Recap edition of the Drive Time Podcast. Your host, Travis Wingfield, brought to you by AutoNation. So defensive back is another one of those premium positions, and not defensive back per se, more so the cornerback spot, right? That is one of your quarterback, receiver, tackle, edge, corner are the five premium positions in the National Football League. And I've seen it from folks out there, folks that you know, folks that I know. Ghost of Adam Gase, what's up, buddy? How you doing? Talking about, like, if they take a cornerback, it's a miss. Dog, no, it ain't. It's never a miss to hit on a great player at a premium position for all the reasons I just laid out. And when I watch these cornerbacks scoot and toot, baby, there was eight of them that ran 40s sub 4.4. There are all kinds of guys in this class that can reroute, that can be physical, that can get up in your face and change the complexion of how these timing offenses want to work, and then have the vertical speed to get deep when they lose their press at the line of scrimmage. And for Miami, where I think you invest in Jalen Ramsey for a long time and make him finish his career here, however long he wants that to be, and you play him at that cornerback position where he can kind of move about, and Coach Weaver talked about his flexibility and how valuable it is to a football team. You maximize that while he has that skill set, and then once he loses a half step, I think he can become one of the best safeties in the National Football League. So for me, I invest heavily in Jalen Ramsey's future, and we know that Cam Smith has a lot of ability. We know that I believe in Cam Smith as much as anybody out there, but you cannot tell me fortifying that position and investing in it for your biggest resource that you have, your first-round draft pick, and to hit on that spot with what you have in Ramsey, with what you have in Kader Kohu, which if Cam Smith works out, these guys would all play at some point, right? Cornerbacks tend to do that. We saw it last year in training camp. The cornerback position each of the last 2 years completely decimated. So I look at the way the cornerbacks ran and some of the guys in this class, like if Quinyon Mitchell, after the way he worked out, I think he's cornerback one now after his combine and Senior Bowl work from Toledo, to overtake a guy from Alabama and Terrion Arnold, who only ran a 4.5, but still goes in the first round, and you think that probably was going to be cornerback one before all the pre-draft stuff happened. And by the way, if he's at 21, wouldn't hesitate either. Terrion Arnold's a great-looking prospect. So my whole point is, if because of some of these workouts and some of the moves and some of how the position board stacks in terms of, you know, Matt Miller talked about it on the podcast last week. I keep reading about it on Twitter. 20 of 32 picks in the first round are going to be offense at minimum. You know, all this talk about the offensive talent and the quarterback position, the offensive line, the receiver position, if that has an impact where it pushes down the corners and edge players and you get another crack at a Jalen Phillips, you get another crack at, in the second round, an Xavien Howard, like, turn the freaking card in, man. I'll take 4 years of elite play for a fraction of the cost of what that elite play cost at a premium position. That's my point. Don't draft for your needs right now. That's a terrible way to do it, terrible way to approach your team building, because next year, guess what? Your needs will be different, and you'd rather have a premier five-star blue-chip cornerback than a 3.5-star center because you need a center in 2024. Get me? So those are the guys that really caught my eye there. I've talked about slot cornerbacks for days in this podcast. Let's go ahead and pivot now to the tight end class, because I wrote down four names here that also worked out that I thought were super impressive. And they are Taylor McLaughlin from Arizona, Jatavion Sanders from Texas. I've talked about Brevin Spanford from Minnesota a bunch, and Ben Sano. I don't know how to pronounce that. I haven't heard it said yet, from Kansas State. But holy moly, man, the Kansas State kid. Let's pull him up real quick. His combine, 4.6, 8.40 was impressive. And I watched him at the Senior Bowl, and he was a tricky evaluation there for me because he got himself in and out of the notes because he kept on wasting fools, like leaving dudes in his dust, in his tracks, and then wouldn't squeeze the football. But you go to the combine, and he's 6'4", and he's 250 pounds, and he jumped a 40-inch vertical and a 10'6" broad. Oh, and by the way, his three cone was better than a lot of receivers at 6.82 with a 4.23 shuttle and a 1.59-10 split. That might be your tight end right there. And I don't know where he goes off the board, but my goodness, what a workout for this guy who also, from Kansas State's program, does plenty of inline blocking and gets himself attached to edges and linebackers and safeties alike in the blocking game. Pretty excited about what he could possibly be for the Miami Dolphins if he winds up a Miami Dolphin. I'm curious what... Let me pull this up real quick, because I think his three cone... Yeah, he was the fastest among all tight ends. What if we get rid of that qualifier? How do you get rid of the qualifier? 6.82. Dude, he was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. He was the ninth fastest three cone. A cornerback, a receiver, three receivers, a running back, a quarterback, a running back, a corner, a tight end shows up in this list. What the hell is he doing there? What are you doing up there? Ben Sano from Kansas State. I am very intrigued by his skill set as that kind of stretch athletic tight end, but also can impact the running game. And then Jatavion Sanders, with the guy that you heard Jordan Reed talk about on the podcast on Thursday from Texas. This guy is impressive, man. Tall, can get down the football field, can pluck the ball off the top of helmets of safeties and just kind of stretch teams inside that way. And we actually heard Tyreek Hill talk about which player in the class he would want the most for the Dolphins to draft on one of his Twitch streams or whatever the hell I'm trying to talk about here. And he said he wants the kid from LSU, Neighbors. And I'm like, Tyreek, Neighbors is going to be a top six pick, bro. You're not going to be there. But Tyreek saying, like, I can play more on the slot. I could be Amon-Ra St. Brown, he said, which was kind of funny. But thinking about the possibility of players of that size that can go outside and win on the perimeter so that Tyreek can get more work inside. Because last year, Tyreek and Waddle couldn't play as much slot. Why? Because we don't have the guys on the outside to win. Cedric Wilson was on an outside guy. River Craycraft's on an outside guy. Baxton Berry was sure as hell on an outside guy. So maybe that's something you look at there, although I still tend to believe that you should go after players that are just good and have speed and are good players, regardless of the type of players you already have in that position group. And that's why we land here on Texas's Xavier Worthy. And if you guys saw me tweet about this, I put a comment up on the old Twitter about his record-breaking 40-yard dash of 4.21 seconds. He eclipsed John Ross, who ran 4.22 back in, was it 09 for the UW Huskies and got drafted by the Cincinnati Bengals. Was it 09? I don't know when that was. I could be way off on that. But yeah, Xavier Worthy is a new record holder for combine 40-yard dash. And there was a play where he catches a jet sweep against some college team. Who cares? You'll watch it anyways. He wins the short corner where the cornerback is in the fit, which is the furthest like portion of the field. Like, it's the perimeter. And Worthy's like, I got you, and just runs right around him, kind of like Tyreek in the Denver game on that opening touchdown when he ran right around a corner who thought he had the angle cut off and didn't and lost, and it was 6 points. Like, that speed, man. You put one more of those guys in the field, just one more of them, like, it multiplies what everybody else, Waddle, Tyreek, HN, like, it multiplies their skill. I am very intrigued by the idea of Xavier Worthy and all these receivers. Man, this is such a good receiver class. It's why I kind of want to move off the first round, use that first round pick for, I don't know, whoever it might be, you know? I think Fatano's gone, the UW tackle, but maybe it's him. If you move back in the draft a little bit, you get an extra third round pick, and you come back and you use that third round pick for a receiver, and the second round pick can be your offensive lineman. Like, there's a lot of options here for the Dolphins, and I think because of the way this class is constructed and the deep positions that you have needs at, like offensive line and receiver, it can afford you the opportunity to kind of sit back and go get those positions at various points of the draft, because there's flavor for everybody at every stage of the draft. I think that's what we learned from this year's combine, was just how deep and how good it is back there. But Xavier Worthy is the one that gets the marquee here, because he certainly earned it, right? How about the running backs? There was a kid from LSU, Isaac, I don't know, I've never heard his name pronounced, which is funny because I watched his opening game for Louisville back on opening weekend in college football. 6'1", 221 pounds, Isaac Garendo, I think it is. He ran very fast, 4.33. I mean, come on, that speed plays in our backfield, right? A 1.55 10 split, 41.5-inch vert, 10.9 broad, 6.9 4.3 cone. He is fast as all get out, and that's what you want in this backfield. And I think I would have no problem turning the card for a fifth-round draft pick on a running back like that, and all of a sudden, I have my next Achane Mostert speed guy. Chris Brooks is in the fold as well. My backfield's done right there. Cut it, call it good, and then maybe in 2 years, your backfield is, you know, 2 years of cheap production with Achane on the rookie contract and Isaac Garendo on the rookie contract. That's something I was looking at with those running back positions. I touch on the offensive line there a little bit. I mean, Troy Fatano is the one that really jumps off the page at you, right? The way he moved, the screen drill, the wave drill, the 40-yard dash, the 10 split. He was 5.01, 171 on the 10 split, which is, gosh, that's choice. That really puts you in premier position in terms of how you move and how you fit in this Dolphins system, right? And that the whole group is like that. Amarius Mims had a crazy, crazy short shuttle time at that size. He is a very rare breed. In fact, I pulled up this great tweet from Josh Norris, who does fantastic work for Underdog Football, and he covers this. He tracks this every single year. It's his offensive line threshold statistic that I think really, it's impossible to argue, quite frankly. Let's go ahead and let's see, where is it? It's my bookmarks. There you go. So his criteria is this: 4.47 short shuttle or better. There was 24 guys that have been drafted since 2010 with that criteria, and the whole list, I mean, it's Nate Solder, Anthony Costanzo, Andre Dillard, yikes, go Cougs, the one miss on there, Eric Fisher, Zion Johnson, Jake Matthews, Joel Batonio, Jake Fisher, Ali Marpet, like, right, star tackles, star players to the next level. And six guys hit that threshold this year. Wisconsin's Tanner Bordellini, 4.28. What? 4.28. He actually also clipped Jason Kelsey's record-breaking three-cone time of 7.2. He was a 7.16 guy. Like, amazing. Amarius Mims at that size, this guy is a freak, man. That's the kind of guy that I could see Miami being like, yeah, let's take a chance on Amarius Mims, because he is height, weight, speed combination to be the best tackle in the NFL with the way he looks. Just hasn't had the college tape, and he's had some injury issues there. But pick 21, that's kind of a gamble you can make in that position there. If he makes it that far, I doubt he does. Kansas's Dominic Puni, we talked about him. with Daniel Jeremiah on the conference call a couple weeks ago. He also got some reps at center, so maybe he can play some of that role. But that's a pretty good place to be right there, right? NC State's Dylan McMahon, 4.45. USC's Jarrett Kingston, former Washington State Cougar transferred. He was 4.47. And then Arkansas's guard, Brady Latham. So, man, like, those are names that you're going to hear on day three. Like, that's, I'm intrigued by that and looking into that as guys to look at. So that's offensive line. We talked about receivers. Quarterbacks is the last one here before our final break on the show. And I still continue to come away from this. I know Caleb didn't throw. I know, you know, a lot of the quarterbacks mostly didn't test. But damn it, the way Michael Penix spins the football is better than anybody else in the class. I know he's got injury issues. I know he doesn't move the way Caleb does for sure. I haven't watched the tape yet. I'm going to do it soon. But I still just feel like Michael Penix, I'm going to come away from this year's draft evaluations thinking he's the best quarterback in the class. I don't know, man. He looks pretty damn good to me. Let's go ahead and take our last break right there. Come back on the other side, and I have some thoughts for you guys. That's next. Drive Time Podcast, your host, Travis Wingfield, brought to you by AutoNation. This isn't going to be any combine coverage right here. I do want to address a couple of things, because one of my favorite things to do on the podcast and in general is to take what other media outlets are doing and give you my thoughts on those thoughts, because I think it's good to have balance and to make where you feel you have some corrections to make, or just to kind of weigh in general and agree with stuff. And so one of my favorite writers out there right now, and this is so true for so many people that I respect, they have taken on this form. I talk to Kyle Krabs about it all the time. And the guy I'm talking about even mentions this on the podcast. Like, they're size queens, man. They're so in love with arm strength. And I was thinking about this the other night sitting on the back porch of my house. Like, arm strength is unanimously agreed upon by most people as like the sixth or seventh most important quarterback trait, right? Like, it's just not that, it's not up there. It's when you need it, it's great, but it's not needed that frequently. It's like having insane mode on your Tesla. You ever using that shit? That stuff? Sorry? On the turnpike? You're not. Imagine if a receiver, you know, like route running, all like stem, stack, catch point, release, hands are important, right? What if, you know, your seventh most important receiver trait is like, I don't know, jump balls, right? Like, it's just not that important. Like, the arm strength argument just has gotten so tired because you rarely need it. You need it sometimes, don't get me wrong, but you rarely need that arm strength to fit balls into those windows down the field. It's great to have it, but I don't understand why all these really smart football minds have gone this way into thinking like big arm, throw ball far. And I'm getting towards Nate Tice, the great writer for Yahoo and does a great podcast with Robert Mays on the Athletic Football Show. And he was on the Around the NFL podcast, which, you know, that's for him, that's like a seminar of education for those guys. But he was talking about on this podcast, and he has Tua ranked like 19th on his quarterback list. He subtweeted a tweet about us paying Tua and was like doing a Simpsons meme about how it's a bad idea. And then he goes on this podcast, and I hear him talk about Caleb Williams. I almost said Caleb Martin. Go Heat, baby. Caleb Williams, and he was like, well, here's the thing, guys. He has all the creativity, and everyone's trying to find these games and these plays and these clips to make it look like he's not a good player. But you go back and you watch the most important things. How does he play from the pocket? How does he attack the middle of the field? He goes crazy throwing the ball to the middle of the field. He's accurate in those positions. He throws on time, and how he hit over 7 yards, adjusted yards per dropback, which is what the great quarterbacks do. And I'm listening to these traits, and I'm thinking, well, all those traits are what Tua is like best in the NFL at. And by the way, 7 yards per adjusted dropback, Tua was well over those metrics each of the last 2 years. And that's what Nate was saying, was those are the metrics that typically, you know, result in the best quarterbacks year in and year out. And like, you look at the list of those quarterbacks, it's Patrick Mahomes. It is Matthew Stafford this year. It is Josh Allen. It's Lamar Jackson. It's Tua Tagovailoa. Like, his peers that he gets measured against, for whatever reason, because his arm is not big arm, throw ball far, he gets excluded from that group. And I don't understand it, because you literally explained in your favorite quarterback traits everything that makes Tua special, and then you disparage the young man. I don't get it. It blows my mind. I hope we have this reversion back to the mean at some point, where people don't think about how you look in shorts, like Zach Wilson throwing the football around an indoor facility, and you start to take into account more film and processing and football and the actual management of situations and games, that's what I want to see and care about. That's why I like Michael Penix so much, and it's why Caleb Williams scares the hell out of me. Yeah, he does have some of that, you know, on-schedule stuff, but all that running around, that ain't going to work, dude. Like, it ain't going to work. Unless you've got Lamar speed, it ain't going to work. So I'm curious to see what he looks like. He terrifies me as a prospect. I feel like Penix, even though the medical's terrible and the age is something to look at, is like safer because I know he can do what's required for an NFL quarterback to win. One more note here. I thought it was hilarious, and one of our favorite people to talk about on the podcast here, a newer Dolphins podcast, was trying to use Ryan Fitzpatrick's passer rating in 2020 to say that he was a vastly superior quarterback to Tua Tagovailoa because he had like 12 points better in passer rating. And the same account will tell you that Tua is nowhere near Justin Herbert. Well, have you seen Tua's passer rating as to Justin Herbert's last 2 years? I just want to put that on the record. It drives me crazy. And speaking of being driven crazy, let's finish up with this. This podcast is kind of all over the place today, so I apologize for that. And I mentioned it, or maybe I'm going to mention it here. I think it's in my notes. But so, okay. Someone on Twitter, I want to finish here because everyone I've talked to has told me how much they love this side of the show or of me, right? Spicy Travis. But one thing you have to know doing this stuff, anything within a smidge of the public eye, is that not everyone is going to like you. Tough for me at first. I wasn't conditioned to accept that lifestyle. Now, 4 years into it, a little bit more so, right? Some people will irrationally hate you for no other reason than some minuscule Twitter interaction that you don't remember from years ago. That always gets me. Like, people also, like, sometimes I have interactions where people come up to me, like, fans, huge fan of the podcast. Travis, we had this interaction 3 years ago on Twitter, and they don't tell me their names. Like, I don't know your name, bro. Like, I'm not, it's, podcasting is like that, right? Like, the person that listens thinks they know the podcaster, and I'm a huge fan of my fans, but I can't possibly know who all you are just by looking at you, you know what I'm saying? So, like, you get this level of, like, back and forth. It's not really tethered to reality. And so I want to start with this because I think Twitter has largely become a useless tool. Did you guys see the reporter, and I'm using air quotes, and we use that term extremely loosely, right? The jack wagon who opened up Caleb Williams' presser with the worst question of all time, right? I'm sure you have, and you'll see he did over 5 million views on that video, which is monetized because of his blue check mark, right? So Elon, lumpy Elon, took this really cool way to connect with sports fans, especially during live events. That, to me, is what Twitter was always about, was watching live events with the rest of the country on Twitter and the rest of the world connecting during a live game. So he took that formula and incentivized idiots to not just be idiots on the platform, like people calling Tua noodle arm to his mom, shut the hell up. Like, that's not what it's for. People calling Javon Holland names, shut up, you know? But now we've seen people take that to real life and do it there because they can monetize it. I had Twitter blue for the season because it's setting money on fire for me not to do that. I apologize. I never thought I'd do that, but I had it, hit the blue check mark. I'd get rid of it in the offseason because I don't tweet enough, and I don't want to be on Twitter that much, to be honest with you guys. I kind of hate it now. So in season, I unblock everyone because it equals more engagement, right? More engagement equals more scratch. Trying to feed my kids, trying to get sweet Caroline her cake pops. Which brings me to the point of a sellout. Now, I don't know if you guys saw this, but somebody called me a sellout on Twitter for taking this job. And called me bitch mate, I think was the term. And by the way, if you get blocked by someone, don't screenshot it and share it. It's not a good look. It doesn't work for you that way. You're bragging about yourself being an a-hole. You're bragging about weird behavior, at least in most cases. Now, I block people when one of the following three things happens. Straight up being rude and insulting. No time for that. Be thick-skinned. Yada, yada, yada. Forget that. It's bad for your mental health to read that stuff on the regular. And if I welcomed it all in, it would be horrible for my mental health. I have to look out for myself. Number two, telling me what my job entails or how to do it or what you perceive me to be in terms of like the propaganda machine, right? Yes, there is red tape. Yes, the podcast has changed. That's clear. I'm not going to crap on our guys on Twitter. You shouldn't either. I'm not going to crap on our guys outside of calling out bad football. You shouldn't either. If you like tagging people's family and commenting under every post with something bad to say, hey, look inward. And that's the third, the constant negativity. I told a fan that he needs a new hobby because he wrote under one of my tweets that wasn't about Tua, that paying Tua was blah, 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 right? The same folks that said not signing Lyle Collins was the biggest mistake we'd ever make and also wanted you to take Najee Harris over Jalen Phillips, right? Those folks. That's not just football, that's life. No time for that nonsense whatsoever. Hell, I mute my own brother. Ryan, I hope you hear this. I mute my own brother sometimes during the season because after the opening drive touchdown for the other team, he gets way too negative, and I don't want any part of that. I get that sometimes negativity, when you vent it, feels better for you, but when you cast that toxicity out there, you're getting your bad feelings onto everybody else. It sucks. I don't like it. I don't want to be a part of it. I have zero capacity for that in my life, especially from a stranger. My brother's one thing, but a stranger, because like, what's the point? You're going to let everyone know all spring and summer how upset you are that the Dolphins are in this position that you think is bad, that they can't compete, they're not a Super Bowl contender, just to be wrong in September, right? Because we always are. It always changes. The perceptions you have of the season never go the way you think they will. And then you spent 6 months on Twitter getting mad for hypotheticals. For what? Who's that for? It's to vent your toxicity, man. So homie got blocked for being a negative B word, quite frankly, then thought he'd do the screenshot thing, and he got cooked by the Trav fans, baby. It was kind of cool to me to watch, because people who actually know me and my character, they came to my defense, and I appreciate you guys for that. So most of the time, I don't see those, and I block them out, but this one I saw, and then I went and played with my daughter, because, like, that's real life, right? The realization is that most of the time, these people are probably children. I get that, but sometimes it's not. Like, there's a guy, Travis Turb, I'll call you out right now, bro. He went on this big thing about how he can't listen to my podcast anymore because we lost 3 games in a row and I wasn't negative enough for him. Man, I was pretty hard on the team of those shows, so I don't think you listen to those podcasts, but I also just have perspective because I'm in the building. I know that's not how the NFL works. No one is emotional like that, okay? I'm also 36, so I know that life, it has ups and downs, and I can handle them. It's my first rodeo. I'm smart enough to also know that a couple of games is not some grand indicator of the next 10 years of Dolphins football. Like, you got to have perspective. We learn these lessons every year, and we refuse to learn from them. I don't get it. So Travis Turb told me he can't listen to the podcast anymore. Still follows on Twitter. Funny. And I bet he comments on this. Just watch. They always do. And then you go back and you look at Travis Turb's tweets, and he was begging me to retweet his collection of Dolphins gear like a child would do. So it's either children or grown men behaving like children, like when the dude who stole the touchdown ball from Tyreek's mom came at me. Like, bro, you steal baseballs from kids at the ballpark. Like, sit down. And the final thing, when people say they go to their truth purveyors, just remember, those truth purveyors ask me, what's a 3 technique, Travis? They don't know the basic 101 fundamentals of the game and have been doing this stuff for 20 years. So if you want to learn nothing and get opinions from that, have at it. All right, Spicy Travis out. Let's go ahead and call it a podcast. Come back on Wednesday. Do the show over, talking about some more offseason outlooks for the Miami Dolphins. All of that coming your way. In the meantime, you all please be sure to subscribe, rate, review, all that fun stuff. Follow me on social at Linkful NFL, the team at Miami Dolphins. So we have the Fish Tank Podcast with Seth and Juice. Check out the YouTube channel for media availabilities, Dolphins Today, and so much more. And last but not least, MiamiDolphins.com. Until next time, fins up. Caroline and Cameron, Daddy.